You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's program:
the United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
It was bound to happen sooner or later. Donald Trump addresses the General Assembly of the United Nations. My guests Robin Lustig and Jane Kinnan-Mont will dissect Trump's speech and the day's other big stories, including...
There have been allegations and counter-allegations, and we have to listen to all of them. And we have to make sure that these allegations are based on solid evidence before we take action.
Is Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi merely ignoring the persecution of Rohingya Muslims in her country, or actually quite keen on it? We'll also discuss whether we'd rather have a good night's sleep or a pay rise, and would you dare board a New York-London flight offering interactive theatre? Or would you literally rather row yourself across the Atlantic with a spoon? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnan-Mont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House, and Robin Lustig, the journalist, broadcaster and former presenter of The World Tonight on BBC Radio 4. Welcome both, and brace yourselves.
Now North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles threatens the entire world with unthinkable loss of human life. It is an outrage that some nations would not only trade with such a regime, but would arm, supply, and financially support a country that imperils the world with nuclear conflict. No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for. Let's see how they do.
We just thought some music would help. Some highlights there anyway of US President Donald Trump addressing the General Assembly of the United Nations earlier today. From any of his predecessors, that speech would have had the cabinet brushing rapidly and anxiously up on the 25th Amendment and sending for a shepherd's crook. From Trump, it was more or less what might have been expected. After kicking off with a few artless references to his own sagacity, he huffed and puffed about North Korea, Iran, and Venezuela in particular, and generally depicted a world teetering on the brink of apocalypse. Robin, any surprises, really, at this point?
Every time Donald Trump speaks, I try to persuade myself not to let him alarm me. And every time it's not going well. I found that speech even more alarming than I expected it to be. That clip that you just played, and thanks, by the way, the music did not help.
We tried.
That phrase, no choice but to totally destroy a country, that wasn't a phrase he just plucked out of the air. That was written into a speech. That was considered. That was discussed. That was a deliberate threat to murder 25 million people, the population of North Korea. How can one fail to be alarmed?
Jane, that's not the first time he's dealt in fairly apocalyptic rhetoric where North Korea is concerned. The excuse made for this, of course, is that this is Trump communicating in language that Kim Jong-un will understand. And you can make the reasonable case that trying to be reasonable with North Korea for many decades has not really accomplished all that much. is this likely, do we think, to sort of alter North Korea's behaviour, this sort of talk?
The internal logic of the speech doesn't quite add up, because he's threatening destruction of a man who he says is on, of a country ruled by a man who he says is on a suicide mission. So that would imply that threats of force were not actually going to work. But I think this type of rhetoric mainly has the ill effect of alarming America's allies and making it more difficult also for countries that are kind of in the middle, like China, to work effectively with the US to rein in North Korea, something that they would probably like to do.
Just to follow that up, though, you talk about alarming America's allies, and maybe 6, 7, 8 months a year ago it might have. But at this point, and it is the evergreen question where Trump is concerned, does anyone take any of this seriously?
Trump really has been testing the limits of the US presidency. You know, supposedly the most powerful man in the world. We know that there are many institutional checks and balances on any US president, but it's being made more obvious now that we have someone who's promising total disruption, but hasn't necessarily changed a lot. Nonetheless, there is still a sense that there's a great deal of unpredictability, and that in foreign policy in particular, the president can have a lot of influence, especially with countries like North Korea, where there's very, very little communication, huge amounts of room for misunderstanding, and currently few back channels to try to de-escalate and calm things down.
I think that's one of the things that does alarm me most. I mean, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un are playing a very dangerous game of call my bluff. Each of them is trying to out-rhetoric the other, out-threaten the other. Each time one of them says something truly blood-curdling, the other thinks he must say something even more blood-curdling. The great risk to all of us is that at some point they will find themselves boxed into a corner where they have left themselves no alternative but to follow through. And it seems that at the moment there is nobody either in Pyongyang or in Washington who can stop these two guys playing this game.
Robin, what did you make of the overall apocalyptic fervour of the speech? He talked about major portions of the world are in conflict and some are in fact going to hell. This is, by any serious analysis, one of the most peaceful and prosperous periods in world history we are presently living through.
Absolutely. And the United States itself, if one looks at the economic figures, for example, low unemployment, economic growth relatively healthy, it isn't as bad as he portrays it, but that is the way he sees the world. He is a deeply angry man, and he is angry at what he perceives to be the state of the world, and more particularly the state of his country, after what he thinks has been decades of misrule. And he believes, and I think his supporters believe, that he is the only man who can make it better. And that's why he has to paint the picture that he paints.
Jane, his remarks on your particular specialty, the Middle East, were mostly confined to Iran. He returned to his obsession with the Iran nuclear deal, calling it the worst and most one-sided deal ever, or words to that effect, which he said before. Does it appear to you that he has an actual substantive objection to the Iran deal, or does he just hate it because it's something Barack Obama did?
Well, in mid-July, he recertified the Iran deal. But that is something that by US
law... It's almost as if what he says and what he does have got nothing to do with
things.
Each other.
Yeah. But according to press reports, at least, it was a very heated discussion where his advisors and ministers basically said to him, you cannot break the deal because we have no good alternative to the deal. And he recertified it. But it remains permanently precarious because the Congress basically passed a law that says the president needs to recertify the deal every 3 months. He has to say that Iran is complying and that lifting sanctions is still proportionate to American interests and the benefits of the deal. So even if Trump maintains the deal, there will be this anxiety every 3 months that it could all fall apart. That in turn means that Iran is not getting the economic benefits it wanted to get from the deal because businesses are leery of investing there, not knowing what could happen the very next quarter. And so the deal, even if Trump sticks to it, could be eroded over time.
Just a final thought on this one, Robin. Did you glean from Trump's speech any sense of a coherent doctrine? Is there a foreign policy philosophy? He did talk a lot about nation states and the sovereignty of nation states. And he did talk about America first in a global context. He does seem to have this idea that all nations should pursue their own interests primarily, and that will somehow be fine.
I think that very much was in keeping with what we have come to understand to be his world vision. Yes, America first. Yes, America strong. Yes to nation states. Deeply suspicious of international institutions and multilateral agreements. It was in keeping with what we have learnt to expect from him. But as you yourself suggested, the difference between what he says and what he does, Iran one case, climate change another, not a word about climate change, on which, of course, he campaigned very strongly before the election. Nothing about Israel-Palestine, which at one time he said he thought was going to be very easy to sort out. I mean, there's a whole load of stuff that he thinks by ignoring it, it's just going to go away.
Well, let's move along slightly, because one notable absence at the General Assembly is Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader of Myanmar. For most of her career, in the event that she'd been freed from house arrest long enough to attend, she'd have been the hottest ticket at any such gathering. The Nobel Peace Laureate and veteran pro-democracy campaigner was, Nelson Mandela aside, possibly the most widely admired political figure on earth, which has only magnified the bewilderment at her apparent acquiescence in the onslaught currently being waged by Myanmar's military upon the country's Rohingya Muslims, at least 400,000 of whom have now fled the country. Jane, she has now spoken after some weeks of silence. She didn't address directly any allegations of abuses, but she says Myanmar, and it was a strange line, does not fear international scrutiny.
Well, she had commissioned Kofi Annan and a team of international experts to look into the situation of the Rohingya and to make some recommendations for policy. So to that extent, she did invite international scrutiny. But now that they have reported and called for change, there appears to be total resistance to any significant change and really a denial about the extent of the problem facing the world's largest stateless community.
It was an odd statement she made, Robin. She seemed to think there was something. I mean, she made a point that most of the Rohingya Muslims have not fled. And this is technically the case because the population is estimated at maybe 1.5 million and only 400,000 of those have fled in terror, leaving behind, you know, jobs, families, lives, homes and so forth. It's not much of an advertisement, really, is it? If only a quarter of a particular population have fled their homes into exile in terror.
It isn't. And I think the big question for all the people who admired her so much during those long years when she was under house arrest is whether she really does believe what she's saying, whether she is in denial about what's going on, or whether she feels she has no alternative but to say the things she is saying, because she still occupies the position she does in Myanmar with the approval and the acquiescence of the military. And she is, in some senses, I saw somebody refer to her as a prisoner in open sight, almost. Personally, and I've never met her, I subscribe to the view that this actually is what she believes. There is a long-established Burmese belief that these Rohingya Muslims are not citizens.
Bengali is the phrase she used,
in fact. That's right. They are the descendants of illegal immigrants, that they don't actually belong in Myanmar, that they oughtn't to be there, and that they threaten the cohesion of the state. My suspicion is that she actually believes that. And one of the problems we have is that during the period when she was under house arrest, she acquired this status as a sort of, as you said, secular saint, second only to Nelson Mandela, which probably she never deserved. We knew very little about what she actually believed, other than that she had immense strength and immense courage in resisting the military at that time, and she spoke very forcibly and very eloquently in favour of human rights and democracy. What she believed about the way in which Myanmar should be run, we didn't know much about. We're learning that now.
Is that fair, do you think, Jane? Did we miss the possibility that Aung San Suu Kyi might have been a bit of an old-fashioned Buddhist nationalist?
I think that's fair. I think there was very little publicity or scrutiny given to the plight of Rohingyas and other refugees from ethnic minorities all around that region. It's only quite recently that this has started to make headlines.
I mean, do we take any of what she said today seriously? I mean, it shows how far through the looking glass we now are that Amnesty International, who of course once would have absolutely revered her and regarded her as a prisoner of conscience, called her speech a mixture of untruths and victim blaming.
Yes, I mean, I think the gloss is bound to come off almost anyone who comes out of opposition and goes into a working compromise with a difficult military regime. We can look also at the opposition in Zimbabwe, but there's still a level of leadership from her in denying this problem that is quite shocking.
Robin, is it possible that Myanmar might be on the way to turning itself back into a pariah state with actual Aung San Suu Kyi in charge of it? Just as we came to air, there were reports that the British military is going to discontinue its association with the Myanmarese military.
I suspect not, because there is a lot of business to be done in Myanmar, and there are a lot of people around the world who have been champing at the bit, waiting for sanctions to be lifted or relaxed so that they could do business in Myanmar. Myanmar has immense potential as an economy, and I think a lot of people, first and foremost, of course, the Chinese, are just only too happy to do business there. And the Rohingya Muslims have relatively few international friends. There is sympathy, of course, for Bangladesh, which is bearing the brunt of this exodus. There is sympathy for the individuals concerned who are living in the most appalling circumstances. Many of them lost their lives. But as a cause, I'm not sure it's going to get very far.
Just a final thought on this one, Jane. Aung San Suu Kyi, I think, for most of the world, has been, you know, the personification of her country. I suspect she's probably the only Myanmarese citizen that most people could actually name. If the Aung San Suu Kyi brand, if you will, is tarnished, if it is damaged, does that damage her country as well?
The country's reputation has long been appalling. But I think now there has been a lot of interest in visiting and doing business and seeing a country that was previously largely hidden from much of the world. So I think this is a blight on it, but not something that's going to utterly send it back into isolation.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Robin Lustig and Jane Kinnan-Mont. Coming up, is sleep more important than a pay rise? And would you, or actually why would anybody, board a plane boasting interactive theatre?
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robin Lustig and Jane Kinnan-Mont. Now, for at least the last few years, the best argument against early rising as a virtuous habit has been the Twitter feed of President Donald Trump furiously thumbing his resentments into cyberspace in the small hours. Further confirmation that dawn is for the birds appears in the shape of a new survey by the National Centre for Social Research here in the UK, suggesting that the strongest indicator of living well was a healthy amount of sleep, to the extent they claim that a longer kip may be better for your general state of mind than a pay rise. Well, Robin, isn't it just the case that actually if you have more money, it makes sleeping easier?
Yeah, absolutely. I want both, thank you very much. I'll take the pay rise and I'll take the good night's sleep. This is completely bonkers, it seems to me. I mean, why on earth would you put the two in opposition to each other? Yes, of course, we know most people need a good night's sleep. People know that on the whole, people are rather grumpy early in the morning. I spent much of my working life over the last 20 years going to bed very late at night and getting up at a reasonable hour. So I got used to having a short night's sleep, but it was a reasonable night's sleep. I was adequately paid. I would have liked to have been paid better, but I didn't lie awake at night worrying that I wasn't going to be able to pay the bills. I'm going to have both if I possibly can.
I mean, I do sympathise, obviously, and regular listeners to Monocle 24 should be assured that there are very good reasons why you rarely hear me doing the early morning shows. It would be an hour of just more or less incomprehensible mumbling and just occasional lapses into sort of long sounds. I don't really function before lunchtime, is what I'm saying. Jane, if you were offered a choice, and as Robin suggests, it's a somewhat fatuous opposition, but let's go with it, between a few extra bob or an extra hour in bed, which would you take?
The sleep really resonates with me. I have an 8-month-old baby, so I'm just emerging from this time when you cannot get more than 3 hours
sleep
at a time. Well, the baby sleeps. This is the thing, is that although they don't let you sleep, they sleep for, you know, maybe 16, 18 hours a day in small sections.
Bits.
So you can see that somebody who is really progressing, expanding their brain, growing, developing, needs a lot of sleep. And while you, on the other hand, are sleepwalking through life, baffled by everything. So I suspect that in terms of ability to live well and cope with life's challenges, sleep is probably more important. There's plenty of research showing that however much money you earn, you always think that you would need more money to be happy. Whereas that's probably not true with sleep. There probably is a point where you think, I've had enough sleep, and now it is a good time to get up and get on with my day, although I'm not personally familiar with that feeling.
But Robin, is there a serious point here that activity has become thought of as inherently virtuous? People boast about how busy they are. They boast about how little sleep they get.
Yeah, I think that's very foolish indeed. They also boast about how busy they make their children be. I'm a great believer that to encourage children's creativity, they should be allowed to be bored, because that then forces them to find a way of amusing themselves. But yeah, I mean, I think we do. It's the Puritan ethic, I suppose. The idea that the more you work, the harder you work, the more frazzled you are, then somehow the more admirable you are and the more you are achieving. I don't think that's true at all. Everything is to do with balance, isn't it? You should work a reasonable number of hours, get a reasonable amount of pay for it, have a bit of fun and get some sleep.
I mean, is there also an issue here, Jane, just thinking in terms of leadership? There's been that furphy that has done the rounds for decades about Margaret Thatcher, that she famously existed on 3 hours sleep a night. And people talked about that. I don't even know if it was true, but people like to think it was. And they talked of that as if it was impressive. It used to terrify the heck out of me, because if I think of my own state of mind on days where I've had that much sleep
Absolutely.
Or less, and it's usually to do with travel or jet lag, it takes me most of the morning to figure out how my own front door works. I don't want the world run by people in that state of mind.
We can only wish that Donald Trump gets a really good night's sleep every night. A long one.
Well, yeah, ideally upwards of about 23 hours. But nonetheless, I do genuinely wonder about this in terms of global leadership, how many huge decisions are getting made by people who are really quite confused.
Absolutely frazzled, don't know what time zone they're on and are totally besieged by information. For people like me, whose job involves trying to communicate research to senior policymakers, one of the things that you're always told is that people have no attention span. You have to condense messages basically to tweet size or maybe to one side of A4. So I think there is quite an issue for senior decision makers that they're totally bombarded with information and don't have that much time to digest and think.
I think Barack Obama said, didn't he, when he was asked what he would do when he left the White House at the end of the 8 years, he said the first thing he would do would be to sleep for 6 months.
No, I can well understand that. But just thinking, even just in terms of, you know, people who aren't running entire countries, do cities need to work harder to protect the ability of people to sleep? I have written down some ideas. One was abolishing GMT. So you just, the UK stays in daylight saving all year, so it doesn't get bright at 5 o'clock in the morning. Further restrictions on flights, and also burning down the homes of people who host loud parties.
That I would be very much in favour of. I would be in favour of banning loud internal combustion engines after 11 o'clock at night, motorbikes, trucks and the rest of it. I have the misfortune of living on a road which has speed humps along it, and so any heavy vehicle that goes over it, particularly in the evening, makes the whole house shake. That disturbs my sleep. I'm also not a great fan of blackbirds early in the morning. We have one particular blackbird outside our bedroom window who, particularly in the spring and early summer, makes a heck of a noise at around 5 a.m. and I'm not a great fan of that.
Okay, well, we shall move along finally to address the worst idea that has ever been had in the entire history of human endeavour. It has been had by Icelandair, who have subjected passengers on a flight between New York and London via Reykjavik to an 11-hour-long immersive theatre production. This would be bad enough in an actual theatre, which you have the option of leaving. Incredibly, however, there are no reports of passengers attempting to kick open the emergency exits in flight and embrace the deliverance offered by a 36,000-foot plummet to oblivion. Jane, is there any imaginable excuse for this?
Perhaps the idea of any publicity is good publicity. It's the first time I've heard of Icelandair.
In fact, I've flown Icelandair. It was fine.
No dramas?
Well, literally. No, there was no immersive theatre on the flight. Was one of the things I most appreciated about it.
I'm going to be grateful for that on more flights from now on.
I mean, Robin, I do commend to listeners looking up the full horror of this. There were actual sing-alongs.
It's impossible to imagine how anybody could come up with an idea that made the idea of long-distance flying even worse than it is anyway. I literally cannot think of anything worse than this idea. I would, if I were on such a flight, kick down the door and jump. I love the theatre. I don't actually like immersive or interactive theatre very much. I don't like long distance flights. When I'm on a plane, all I want is to be left alone, served food and drink at regular intervals, and please nobody talk to me and make the least amount of eye contact possible.
that's basically how I live life. But I was when I first read about this, I was thinking, is 11 hours long enough to fashion from sufficient of those seat back napkins some sort of parachute? Because it comes from, Jane, the reason they did this, apparently. Robin was saying what he wants on flights is to be left alone. Apparently, that is a minority predilection. A recent study, and by who, I've no idea, found that people were bored on flights and thought that the cabin crew could make flights more enjoyable. And this is what we end up with. What if this spreads?
I think there's been some misinterpretation of the survey results. I think they're probably thinking more like, you know, bring me more wine.
Yeah. Or make the films better or something. But please do not prance about and start singing in the aisles. It's just a horrendous idea.
I'm desperately worried this could spread. And because occasionally the sort of things like this happened. I am in the fairly regular habit of flying to Australia over Christmas Day, because it's kind of cheaper and I'm not really fussed about Christmas terribly much. I did fly with one airline last year, and the clenching feeling in my throat when I boarded at, where was it? Either Abu Dhabi or Dubai, and the crew were wearing, you know, Christmas variety things.
Oh boy, that's a bad sign.
I spent 15 hours braced for Christmas carols, which mercifully did not come, but... Where does this come from?
I mean, I'm the kind of passenger who even cringes when the pilot comes on the intercom and starts being a bit too chatty. I'm very happy for the pilot to tell me when we're going to take off, when we're going to arrive, what the weather's like. If he has to tell me what his name is, fine. I don't really care what his name is. But when he starts chatting, I think, just shut up and fly the plane.
Are you similarly antisocial on flights, Jane?
Well, I am a Londoner, so these kinds of instincts do kick in, especially when there's... basically no escape.
I will say, to try and end proceedings on a slightly more upbeat note, I have been on one flight where the pilot did actually attempt to engage the passenger manifest, and it was a genuinely great moment. It was a flight from London, I think, to Los Angeles, and it flew over Greenland-ish, and he just came on the intercom and said, I've been flying this route for years. I have never seen conditions like this over Greenland. It is absolutely as clear as a bell. The view is astounding. He said, I want everyone to take a turn at a window. So make sure your neighbours all get a go at a window. You have never seen anything like this.
That's worth doing.
And he was absolutely right, and it did genuinely cheer up the rest of the schlep to California.
I can live with that. I once did a flight from Kathmandu to the capital of Bhutan along the tops of the Himalayas, and the pilot did actually identify each of the peaks as we passed, and that was useful information. But don't start acting out in front of me. That will not do.
I hope he passed them at a reassuring height.
Oh, we did.
That does bring us to the end of today's show. Robin Lustig and Jane Kinnamont, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The programme was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mariana Lagrasta and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next at 1900 at Section D. Emma Nelson has more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.